Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. As always, friends, thanks for listening in. This week, we have a great show coming up for you here today. We're going to be talking about the history of the old Absinthe House located on the corner of Bourbon and Bienville Streets there in the French Quarter. A very famous bar, used to be one of the most famous bars in the world back a few decades ago. And they have a new bar in the sort of complex there, if you will. It was in the original main dining room of Tony Moran's restaurant, which was a part of the scene there. And it's called Belle Epoque. It's a great absinthe lounge, parlor, speakeasy. And so what we're going to do, we're going to talk to two folks. We're going to talk to Laura Bellucci, our good pal, who is the bar director there at Belle Epoque. We're going to talk about absinthe, talk about the program, all kinds of cool stuff, the really cool space that they have there, how you can check it out. And then we're going to talk with Dave Wunderich, I think quite convincingly the most famous cocktail historian on the planet. And Dave is going to join us after we chat with Laura for a bit. We're going to talk about the history of the old Absinthe House going all the way back to the 19th century, its origins, how it changed hands. It was part of the Brennan family for a while there in the 20th century. All kinds of really interesting stuff. And actually, there's such a detailed story there. We kind of give you a 30,000-foot level view. And if you're listening on the radio, I will encourage you to get the podcast because Dave sticks around and we get into some things about how the old Absinthe House ties into the development and history of drinking culture in New Orleans. Always a place with a drinking culture, right? And an interesting one. And then Laura joins us again where we talk a little bit more about the current landscape of absinthe, both stuff coming out of the old world and stuff coming from the new world and so on and so forth. So a very, very interesting conversation all centered around the old Absinthe House. Going to be a lot of fun, really, really interesting stuff. We're going to bounce over to Belle Epoque in just a second to chat with Laura, but I wanted to give a quick shout out to our friends there at the Bloody Mary Fest. It's a We talked about it last week. We had Evan Weiss, the organizer, on. They travel around the country and put on a festival about, you guessed it, Bloody Marys. And the third annual stop was in New Orleans over the weekend. They were kind enough to ask me back to judge the competition. It was a great time, lots of fun. And a quick shout out to the winners, at least for the judge award portions. They do a people's choice thing. But us judges, we came up with the Ruby Slipper Cafe as the best original recipe. And second place was Wake and Bacon. Best traditional recipe was the Country Club. Very fine establishment there in the Bywater. Go check them out. And the Maison, a fine music club, actually, that does food as well and drink and so on and so forth. They're on Frenchman Street. Best garnish, the winner was once again the Country Club. And second place was Wake and Bacon. Also, a very fine mix. We were asked to judge mixes for the first time this year, and that was really interesting. And that went to Dimitri's Bloody Mary Seasonings. That was really, really good, by the way. And also two other really good ones that tied for second, Middle Bar and the Bloody Buddy. I was very impressed. Had a lot of fun. Go check out those places. You can go check out the website, thebloodymaryfest.com. You can see the winner, see where they're going next, other stops. And they will be back next year in New Orleans. And I imagine I'll be there too. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to bounce over to Belle Epoque and chat with Laura Bellucci, bar director. Then we're going to chat with cocktail historian, the one and only Dave Wunderich. Come on back.
I got nothing in my pocket. I got holes in both of my shoes.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week, as always. And yes, you know, we are here at Belle Epoque, part of what I will call the Old Absinthe House Complex. How's that? And we're talking about the history of the Old Absinthe House that we'll get into with Dave Wunderich in just a little bit. But I'm pleased to be joined by my first guest and pal, bar director Laura Bellucci. How are you, Laura?
I'm amazing.
Awesome.
Thank you for
you
having
are amazing.
Me.
It's great to see you, too. Awesome. And things are going great here. The doors opened up to,
yeah,
to the public a couple weeks ago, right?
Three weeks old.
We're
just a little bar baby, but we're already doing great.
A little bar baby. That's awesome. So the space that we're in is Belle Epoque, and it's an absinthe lounge. And it's part, as I said, part of the old Absinthe House. So we're in this really cool, sultry space. And I'll get you to talk about the program in a second. But this was the old main dining room for Tony Moran's,
yeah,
right, the restaurant.
Yeah, so it was an Italian restaurant. Then it closed down for a couple of years, and I think a couple people maybe thought about working on it, but then went away, and then I came onto the scene, I guess.
There you go. And then had this great idea to do, because we're going to talk about the last chapter of the history. This will all make sense later when we do the podcast, The Only Thing With You, Laura. But what was kind of the impetus to do an absinthe lounge in general and in this space?
Well, I just think that there is, I mean, even when I worked at Sobu, I saw this crazy demand and curiosity about it. So I was already like, people want to drink this stuff. They want a sort of situation where they can really explore it and kind of try it out. And something that's not too scary, something where they feel kind of safe, but they're still getting an education on what it is and kind of debunking the myths about it and learning while they're drinking. And so this building is such a historic spot for absinthe. I know you talked to Dave, and it's just, we've been serving absinthe since the 1840s. They have like bills of sales of absinthe coming into the building. So it's one of the oldest spots in America for absinthe service. So to me, that coupled with kind of when I came in here, because I came in here to consult on a menu for them.
Okay.
And just kind of give them a menu, and that was supposed to be the end of it. But then when I saw the space and when I looked around the building and kind of saw the upstairs event spaces and these beautiful chandeliers and sort of a lot of the building falling into like disuse and decay, I was like, there's so much potential here. And so I basically talked them into taking me on as a manager for this and a manager for the project.
Okay, and here you are.
And well, here that's I exciting. Am.
Well, let me ask you this question, Laura, just as a quick tangent, because I find that, I guess I've been sort of around the world of absinthe, if you will, for several years now. So I kind of forget this part. Do people still kind of like freak out and trip out on it?
Yeah, they act. That's the common misconception about absinthe is that you trip, but that's like the number one question
I shouldn't have said
I
it that
get.
Way. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's the number one question I get about it is the worm going to kill me? Is it going to make me trip? Is it poison? So sort of dealing with that part of it has been crazy. And like there's this crazy... There's those people who kind of know nothing and are just excited, which is awesome. We love them. They're our favorites because we train for this.
Sure, right.
But then there are the intense absinthe community, the people who make it and the people who are in forums online, and they are so passionate. I don't think I've ever met a smaller, more passionate community in the spirits world.
Wow, and that's saying something.
It can
that's,
feel yeah. really overwhelming, I think. If you're really like into rum or you're really into whiskey, that's such a big world. And for us and for me, it was such a treat to pick a world that was kind of accessible. Mm-hmm. And they kind of wanted to play with us and to talk to us and to come here and to give us bottles and kind of tell us what they're doing to make their absinthe special. And so I think they are kind of under-recognized. But the people who like absinthe are some of the most passionate drinkers
yeah,
I've ever met.
That's very cool. It's interesting. I mean, it makes sense, but it's also very interesting to hear when you consider, as you said, whiskey drinkers, rum drinkers, bourbon drinkers, you know, very strident in their fanship of said beverage.
Oh, but their world is so much bigger. This community is tiny, and even though they're international, they still kind of make time to get together and talk online and kind of interact with each other in a way that I haven't really seen in such a sort of I don't know. It feels really local.
Is it the kind of thing then where there's at least with most producers, a sensibility that, I hate using this hackneyed expression, but a rising tide raises all boats?
Yeah.
Meaning that like if we
exactly.
grow the category, it's good for everybody.
Oh yeah. And they're just so excited that any bar is celebrating the product that they spend so much time on and put so much care into. So it was so fun to link up with them because I was excited and then they were just matching my excitement. So it was just a really inspiring part of the project was sort of getting to know the distillers and the makers.
Well, cool. Now when we do the podcast, I'm only saying with you, we're going to talk a little bit more about the landscape that is of absinthe today with the growing number of producers and some other things, different styles and so on. But let's talk about harnessing that enthusiasm then, and let's talk about the program here. So absinthe driven, of course, but great food and great cocktails and
beautiful space.
Yeah,
so the idea is sort of like a boudoir lounge where you can come get small plates. Haley's got an incredible food program
in the kitchen.
That's
Chef Haley Van Fleet, yeah.
She's really worked hard to kind of make all of her dishes pair with the absinthe, which I think was kind of tricky for her not being a drinker and also kind of being new to absinthe.
Okay.
It's kind of like I had to like ambassador absinthe to everyone on this team because no one had really drank it or played with it as much before. So we really had fun kind of doing that. And there's like absinthe mignonette and tarragon sauces and stuff like that on the menu. But there's also just, it's less absinthe in the dishes and more dishes that go with absinthe. And then the cocktail program is sort of like a scaled cocktail menu with most to least or least to most absinthe to sort of get you where you're comfortable.
As far as the quantity goes.
Yeah,
oh, okay,
so I have drinks with no absinthe, and I have drinks with like a teeny bit, just like a back note, and then drinks that are like half and half, and then drinks that are all absinthe. So you kind of start where you're comfortable, and then you like move your way up.
Oh, that's
hopefully.
A great idea. I didn't know that part. Okay.
Yeah. And then we have flights, as many flights as we can to sort of tell the story of absinthe. We have American ones, so you can see kind of the crazy absinthes that are coming out of America right now. Mm-hmm. And we have the French ones if you want to go classic and sort of like refined. And that's kind of fun too for novices because they get to try a lot and kind of play around with that format of having the fountain service and the like with the whole shebang.
Yeah, let's talk about that because you mentioned it. There are two of the original absinthe drips sitting on the bar here that you guys had painstakingly restored.
Yeah, when we came in here, I think that they had been kind of running on and off for a while and not really watched, and they hadn't been hooked up to filtered water or water that was like, we have a water filtration system, but it's just not enough for something so historically sensitive.
Okay, sure.
So they're from 1873, so they had all of these years of calcification on them, and then they had kind of just corroded a little bit, and the shine on the marble was dull, and there was just kind of a lot, and the little pieces were broken off the statues.
Let's be clear, New Orleans water is going to be a culprit in all this.
Yeah, it was definitely the culprit, for sure. I think we can definitely blame it a lot on New Orleans water. But yeah, they were from 1873, and everyone I talked to in the process of trying to get them restored already knew about them.
Oh,
and that was the really
okay.
strange part, is everyone I would call would be like, oh yeah, we've heard of them, but we don't want to work on them because they're priceless. And I was like, well, somebody has to work on these because we have to get them restored. So it took me about 3 months before I found Emily Ford from Oak and Laurel Restoration, mm-hmm. who paired up with Pierre McGraw from the Monumental Task Force, and as a team they approached it, and I think that made them feel more comfortable with these priceless objects, and they reworked the interior water system, and then we hooked it up. Now we have it hooked up. Instead of like a water line, we have it in a copper pot that's on a gravity system to put filtered water through them only, and we can control that, so mm-hmm. we never have to worry about that happening.
And that's a key part, I mean, of absinthe, right? Because we are dripping water, and the water itself is a really an integral component to any absinthe drip or cocktail, right?
Absolutely. It's huge. So the water is really with the sugar, the only other component you're going to experience. And it's a backdrop, and it helps the absinthe bloom is what I would say, like the flavor of it. It helps it kind of all come forward from this intense distillate into this sort of beautiful blossomed milky drink. Mm-hmm. And so you need good water to do that. Otherwise, you'll miss some of the flavors, or it's just not going to be as clean. Your understanding of the product is not going to be as clean.
Gotcha. Now, are we talking about, too, with the cocktail program, and we'll get a little further into this in a bit in the podcast section, but some classic absinthe cocktails, because there are plenty of classic ones out there that have been there for decades, and then some new ones, right?
Yeah. So for me, it's a lot of, for the classics, just my staff is super trained on them. So we just have that in our back pocket. And then we have a couple of classics on the menu. But mostly we wanted to focus on semi-familiar cocktails that sort of bring absinthe into play, being something you've never seen before. Like the Baudelaire is a daiquiri with absinthe. And then we have on our like late night happy hour, we have a pina colada style, not blended, but a shaken pina colada style with absinthe. Just so you're not totally overwhelmed by newness, but you're still kind of trying something weird and wacky, and seeing how it affects drinks is really interesting.
That's very interesting. So, and like in general, is it kind of when you start developing these and doing the R&D on them, so maybe taking a classic and then swapping out the base pair with absinthe and then see what it does and then sort of modify from there? Or
sort of taking a classic and adding as much absinthe as you can before you absinthe.
I like that approach.
Yeah. So it's basically pushing how much absinthe we can squeeze into every drink, but also kind of being mindful of drinks that just work with a little absinthe on the back. Or it's kind of just a crazy seasoning in all cocktails, and it really, you can mm-hmm. use it as a back note, as bitters, as like a spoonful just to enhance the flavor. It's very much like an enhancer use it in small quantities. And then in larger quantities, it's much harder because to get it to play with other spirits.
I was just going to say that it's a tricky one to work with, isn't it? So I'm sure there are sometimes, like you think on paper, this is going to be a great idea. Then you taste it and you go, ooh, not so much.
All the time. That has been the last year of my life. Where I'm just like, this is really bad. but you got to find out. I think, you know, it's easy to come at it since absinthe is often like a great base spirit or a great base distillate. Like, it's easy to go with a cognac or something like that is in like kind. I think that's an easier place to start, but it can work with anything. And when you go botanical, it's great to do it with gin because then you have those botanicals playing together,
right?
Then you have to find the right gin, and it's been a crazy time.
And the right absinthe, right? Because of the variation out there that we'll get into. Well, look, we got about 3.5 minutes left or so before we're going to take our first break here with this part of the show. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to tell us a little bit more about the space, because you guys brought some clown in to do the space, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. We brought Sylvia Thompson-Diaz in to do our beautiful walls, which people have been talking about. Shameless plug.
It's my wife. All right,
it's
sorry.
Shameless.
We'll move on.
We love her, though. We love you guys. So it's fine. We plug you all the time because we love you. But I think she really helped us transform the space into something really elegant. And for me, that was like a little bit of something that would have been a tricky thing for me because I would have done like all rainbows and gold and sunshine. And it would have been just madness in here. So having like a grown-up with like a very serious design perspective around was really helpful because it would have been total chaos if left to my own devices.
And knowing you as well as I do, that's a great response. Right on. Cool. And it's very sultry in here. And the whole thing is meant to be that kind of – it creates a great ambiance to sit around the cocktail program and the food program. It's a place that you want to come and just kind of chill and sit in comfy chairs and sip on absinthe and eat good food.
Yeah, she picked the comfiest chairs in the world for this
Spot. Right on. Cool. So what – at least at this point, you guys are and I know it just opened, so sometimes these things change, but open Thursday through Sunday?
Yep,
right?
Thursday through Sunday. Thursday is 4 p.m. to 2 a.m., and that's true Friday and Saturday as well. And then Sunday we open a little early at 3 in case you want to drink absinthe after the game. And then we close at 1 because everyone's trying to go to bed.
Yeah, at 1 a.m. I got to clarify that for those old people.
Oh, 1 a.m.
Yes, right. Okay, good. And so when you come in, so it sits behind, as I mentioned, it was the old dining room most recently for Tony Moran's. So the world famous old Absinthe House bar on the corner of Bienville and Bourbon. So you got to kind of slide your way back here, don't you, to find it.
So we have our speakeasy door, which we keep open as often as we can. But sometimes when it's really busy in here, we got to close it because the Bourbon Street Courtyard is also open. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of people just kind of flowing in and drinking absinthe and getting pretty wild.
There you go. And it's cool. The thing I like about it is that we really are just a stone's throw off, even shorter than that, off Bourbon Street. But it is sort of a world away in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah. I just wanted somewhere kind of quiet to duck off into after work is kind of how I thought about it. Mm-hmm. Just something in the French Quarter that was beautiful and offered like a lot of different stuff and a lot of exploration, but was not sort of in the midst of all the craziness.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Got it. Well, do me a favor, Laura, before we take this break here and come back with Dave Wonder to talk about the history of the building, tell people where they can find Belle Epoque, like street address, online, all that good stuff.
Oh, we are 240 Bourbon Street, right inside of the old Absinthe House. If you can't find us, just ask one of the bartenders. And the website is rubourbon.com.
Awesome. Very cool. And at Belle Epoque, right, on the gram and
at
all that?
At Belle Epoque NOLA.
On Facebook and the gram. Cool. Very good. Well, what we're going to do, friends, is we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Then we're going to come back, as you know, and chat with Dave Wondrous, who I would say, I think you would agree with me, Laura, probably the foremost cocktail historian on the planet, right?
Yeah, he's so cool.
And he's such a great dude, too. He's a friend of ours. And Dave's has done extensive research, as I mentioned, on the space. And so we will talk with Dave and get that. And then Laura's going to stick around, and we're going to do, after we finish up with Dave, we're going to do another little segment here. We're going to talk about the landscape of absinthe in the world today.
Yeah.
Awesome. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back. We'll be right back. right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening to the Noel Drink Show, friends. This week, as always, we're going to bounce back over to Bella Park in just a little bit and talk with Laura about the space further. But I'm pleased to be joined by my next guest and friend, Dave Wondrich, who has done extensive research on the old Absinthe House and the space there. Dave, welcome back to the show, man.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for taking some time out. You're up there in New York right now, Dave?
Yeah, in Brooklyn, sitting here in my bunny slippers.
Very nice. Yes, friends, we're doing this by phone, and I'll tell people that I have pants on if they want to believe me. I'm sitting in my home studio, but
that's their business.
That's right, exactly. Well, Dave, you did a four-piece set of stories, all connected together, talking about the history of Old Absinthe House from its earliest beginnings and myths all the way to the present day. Wonderful work there. It can be found in the Daily Beast, and we'll remind you of that. But what we're going to talk about here is really the history of the space, and I'm just going to toss it to you, man. We start out in the 19th century, right? And some stuff that might make us lead to believe it was earlier, but that's kind of BS.
Well, I mean, you know, the history of the Old Absinthe House is not easy to uncover, because the history of all saloons is, you know, there weren't historians sitting there writing down, oh, they opened a saloon on the corner. You know, right. It's just, you got to piece it together from little bits and pieces wherever it surfaces. And I was able to piece together a lot of them, but I'm sure there's more out there that will change some of the details. But nonetheless, it's such an interesting story. You know, it's the oldest bar in New Orleans, one of the oldest bars in America. And it has this long, long history of just being a famous drinking place. And for a while, it was one of the most famous bars in America. Maybe, you know, it was in the top five, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts, well, that's already a problem. It's like around 1900, they were claiming that it opened in 1806 or 1812. 18 something, you know, really early.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as we can tell, that wasn't the case. The building was built around 1806. There's nothing on the property in 1788, 1794. There was a great fire.
Right.
This was just outside the zone of destruction, but we don't really know, you know, what was on the space. But there were a couple of Catalans who built a building there sometime by 1808, something like that. These guys, Juncadella and Font, were their names. They didn't open it as a bar. They built it as like a store, a warehouse, the usual, just basically commercial building.
Mm-hmm.
And, you go and try to find when it opened as a bar. It's very difficult. The earliest definite notice we have is 1842. And that's very firm. There's an article, an ad in the Daily Picayune, where the members of the Washington Fire Company No. 4 thank Mr. Alakes, who is the kinsman of the Juncadellas, who was running the place and as a bar, and they thank him for sending refreshments.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that they were serving drinks in 1842. Before that, it was for a long time the residence of the parish treasurer, who was a pretty high muckety-muck in local government. And I can't imagine he was living over a bar. It seems probably like that was wrong. He was an accountant and, you know, they were very respectable sort.
Mm-hmm.
And he left in the late 1830s. So that's probably when they opened it as a bar.
That's the best
we can kind of come up with.
And so we know the Alakes have it and then operate it from 1842 at the latest.
Yeah, they're firm from 1842. And what they're running is basically, it's a coffee house. It's a small one. They've got, you know, some tables. There's a bar. There's a big mirror. There's some bottles. They are definitely apparently serving absinthe anyway, pretty early on, because the place gets an early reputation and gets the name Absinthe run by the 1860s. So they were, it implied that they've been doing it for a while and that's their specialty. But they were also serving a lot of wines and, you know, not really like making American drinks. Mm-hmm. I don't think they were serving a lot of cocktails. New Orleans drinking was pretty different then. In the French Quarter, you drank French and Spanish style, mostly out in the, in what was known as the American Quarter, now the Central Business District. That's where you got most of the cocktails and things like that.
Yeah, and this is something, sorry, Dave, this is something I want to ask you when we get into the podcast only section, because I want to talk about that differentiation. Yeah, so we kind of move, the Alexes have it, and we kind of move forward through the 19th century.
Yeah, they've got it through the 1851. It gets trashed in anti-Spanish rioting in the French Quarter over something that happened in Cuba, but they brush themselves off and go right back to it. In 1861, the Alake's sons, Jacinto and Leopold, joined the local militia, and they're big Confederate States of America guys. And so even this, despite their place being trashed, they got over that and kind of associated with the local cause pretty strongly. Mm-hmm. After the Civil War, they resumed business for a while. And they open up another second bar in the French Opera House down on Bourbon Street, mm-hmm. down a few blocks. And they promptly go broke in that. That was not a good thing for them to run. Also, Leopold is turning out to be somewhat of a sorehead, the guy who was running the thing. And he gets involved with all kinds of right-wing causes and stuff like that, and has business problems. But the one thing they did do is take the barkeeper that they had hired at the opera house, this guy Gaetano Ferrer, another Catalan, and bring him over to the Absinthe House. And by 1872, he's in charge of the place. Mm-hmm. And he runs the place for 10 or 15 years until he dies. Then his sons run the place. At this point, they've redecorated, and you can see postcards of the decorations that they put in. That's when the earliest photos of this place are. And it's, still a small place. There's a bar along one wall and these two absinthe fountains. So they've already put those in probably in the 1870s, maybe the 1880s when they redecorated. They're running this place and it's starting to advertise it as the oldest saloon in the city, which it's pretty close. Most of the older saloons had been closing right and left in the 1880s. So suddenly they're a survivor. Mm-hmm. And they're saying 1836 that it was open. I think it was a little after that. Nobody who was there when it was opened was involved with it anymore. So they're kind of, being a little rough on their estimate. But by the 1890s, this place starts taking off. Before it was a quiet little neighborhood place, and suddenly it's popular because New Orleans is turning into a tourist destination. Mm-hmm. The railroads are promoting it heavily as a as a source of revenue in the winter when travel is down, and they say people should go down to New Orleans. And one of the attractions of New Orleans is its bars. And the railroad basically picks out three of them and makes them famous. The Sazerac House, the Ramos's Bar.
Stag Cafe, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, it was the Imperial Cabinet then.
Okay.
It was before the Stag. That's over across from the St. Charles Hotel in the Central Business District, mm-hmm. where you've got Henry Ramos making his gin fizzes in huge volume. And then you've got the Sazerac House on Royal Street. Below Canal on the kind of the American Quarter always flopped over one block across Canal into the French Quarter.
Yeah,
exactly. That block between Customs House, as it was called then.
Right.
Hey, Dave,
sorry, let's do this really quick. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and continue with the story. Okay. Is that work for you? Okay, hang on 1 second, friends. We're going to take a little break. Yeah, take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, friends. We'll be right back.
Well, after I'm through,
we'll
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Friends, we're chatting with Dave Wondrich, cocktail historian, and we're talking about the history of the old Absinthe House. And we got ourselves, Dave, where do we get ourselves to when we took the break before?
We're around 1900.
Right,
the old
okay.
Absinthe House is absolutely booming. Every tourist has got to go there. All the celebrities are stopping in. These guys are during the tourist season, they're making a fortune. The problem is all the tourists drive out their regulars. So for the rest of the year, they're broke. So they keep their business keeps wobbling, and they keep running into business difficulties. And
funny how some things never change here in New Orleans, Dave.
Sell the place. Yeah, you know.
Sorry, go on.
Seasonal stuff is tough. You know? I mean, it's like you're a fisherman with tourists.
Right.
You never know where the fish are running.
But 1913, sorry.
Yeah, 1913, it was the same. I mean, so they sell out to this French guy, Pierre Casaubon, who was a feisty guy from the mountains in the south of France. And he runs the place with a little more energy until Prohibition. And he keeps one of the Ferrers on, Jacinto or Joe's, as bartender. And Joe's Ferrer starts collecting people's business cards and tacking them up on the walls. And so, that amuses him, and that starts to really, like, set the decor.
So, Dave, and so what we're seeing here is, you know, some of the continuity of the traditions and the decor, and then even with some of the distant kin relationships and previous family business relationships are kind of rolling over through these different ownerships in different periods.
Exactly. There's a lot of overlap. You know, there are very few clean breaks in the history of the Absinthe House. So Prohibition rolls in, and our friend Pierre Casaubon is simply not having it. He keeps selling booze. He keeps getting busted over and over again. And finally, the place gets padlocked for a year, which is how the Prohibition authorities dealt with this stuff. 1928, he opens it up again, and he's losing the lease. So he immediately takes all the fixtures, which he says he bought in 1913, moves them down the street to an empty bar room, and opens that up as a speakeasy with the old Absinthe bar. So he's got the bar from the old, he gets busted there a couple times, and then repeal happens, and you've got the old Absinthe bar, a block down Bourbon, and then there's the old Absinthe House. Meanwhile, the old Absinthe House is turned into a dance hall with one very colorful owner among them, who was from Boston and ran the most popular bar in Panama. And
the country we're talking about, right?
Yeah, the country, yeah, okay. Exactly. In Panama City. And she would winter up in New Orleans, and she buys the Absinthe House buys the lease, and gets busted a couple times, or nearly gets busted, and runs it as a speakeasy and a dance hall. She eventually retires to New Orleans and works with a madam for a long time. She was very colorful.
Mamie Kelly, correct? Is that her? That's who we're talking about?
Yeah, Mamie Kelly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, eventually repeal, she gives up the place, repeal comes, and it's just being run still as a dance hall. There are a couple of Italian guys in charge of it. They're not really doing much with it. They've got dance bands in there, and really not much going on. And it kind of starts to look pretty shabby and falls apart. This guy, John Marchese, is running it, you know, with this business in the 1940s, early 1940s. And a young man about town who kind of knew everybody in town, named Owen Brennan, who was working for Shenley, the liquor company, going around and, you know, basically being a rep. He stumbles on this place and says, you know, I'm going to buy this. I need a business. I'm tired of moving around. He buys the Absinthe House and revitalizes it completely. He's a very energetic, very hospitable guy. He turns it into like the hottest club on Bourbon Street, or certainly one of them. He gets this guy, Walter Fats Pichon, a piano player extraordinaire, to sing there every night. He fixes the place. He puts it, exploits the hell out of this marketing myth that had been started there years before, that it was where Jean Lafitte and Andrew Jackson planned the Battle of New Orleans, which it wasn't. And but he puts in a museum. He does all this crazy stuff. It's really a wild place, and it becomes insanely popular again. Everybody is there. It goes on and goes on. Owen Brennan dies early, unfortunately. The family keeps running it, and then in 1959, they sign a deal with the ABC network to have a TV show shot there. Meanwhile, the building is kind of falling apart, so they pretty much rebuild it. And the show never really works. And
it was like a detective show, right? And they wanted to come film part of it there, and they put some money into restoring the space.
It's a local version of 77 Sunset Strip, where you've got like the place the detectives hang out, and then they go around solving crimes, and you know, meanwhile there's like dancing and music and stuff like that, so it's all very lively. But it just didn't work, and so ABC sells it back to the Brennans. Then in 1964, the Brennans, meanwhile, have gone on to other things. They've got Brennan's restaurant. They're expanding, and they're really less interested in running the bar. That was Owen's thing, and they're more interested in being restaurateurs. So they finally sell it. They tried running it as a restaurant. That didn't really work. And they sell it in 1964 to Diamond Jim Moran, who was a very colorful person. Mm-hmm. With some ties to various local mobsters, but his sons, on the other hand, are in charge of the place, not him, and they are much more interested in the hospitality business. One of them goes to cooking school, even, and they run it for a very long time, but you know, Bourbon Street by the 1960s had started to get pretty rough, and by the 1970s even rougher. And a lot of seedy stuff happens at the bar in the 60s and 70s, just partly because of the nature of Bourbon Street.
Now, Dave, we got about a minute and a half left or so for this part, just before we got to take a break again.
Okay, so anyway, it finally reaches equilibrium around 1990. The criminal. Time, it's also not really a very fancy place, and that's how it was through the 2000s and most of the 2010s. It changed hands a couple, at least once, and new owner was biding his time, and now they finally put some money into it, and I'm looking forward to see fancy drinking back in the space.
Yeah, and so for locals that will know the place, so that was, we're talking about Bricado and Moran buying the place, and so that the backspace there, which is now Belle Epoque, that we were talking about in the first part of the show, and we're going to talk about again with Laura, and we'll talk about the current era now. That was Tony Moran's, which was a Creole Italian kind of place, and had like mob ties to Carlos Marcello and things like that, as you said. So,
but it seems like Tony himself, like, really, was had a long connection to the food business, which is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
You don't normally. That's next level stuff.
Right. As sort of an accidental tourist in that world, it's even like the current owner can maybe be kind of viewed that way. But we'll get to that in the segment with Laura. Well, do me a favor, because we got about 30 seconds left before we close out this portion of the show. Dave, you're going to stick around for another segment, for another shot with Noel Drinks on the podcast. But tell people real quickly, where can we find the articles and where can we find you online?
They're on the dailybeast.com. Just search Absinthe House and on the Daily Beast and you'll find it. Right for the Daily Beast. I've got my books Imbibe and Punch and a few others that are out there about American drinks and their histories. And I'm working on the Oxford Companion to Spirits and Cocktails right now. I'm the editor-in-chief. That's a big multi-year project, but we're slowly pulling it into port, so that's good.
Cool. Well, Dave, you're going to stick around. Friends, if you're listening to the radio, go to noladrinks.com, get the podcast, because you're going to hear our continued conversation when we get a little more into the weeds here with Dave, and get back with Laura and them at Belle Epoque as well. So, friends, if you're listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all.
like this. I said, I call your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. Then he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Hope you are enjoying our conversation here with the one and only Dave Wondrich talking about the history of the old Absinthe House. I know we had to kind of rush through it pretty quickly to get some of the key information in the radio portion of the show. We're going to bounce back over to our chat with Dave by phone in just a second and delve into a few interesting topics as it relates to the place and also how that factors in or perhaps reveals a bit about drinking culture in New Orleans. And then after we finish up our chat with Dave, we are going to head back over to Belle Epoque, the Absinthe Lounge there connected to the old Absinthe House, and chat further with Laura Bellucci. And we are going to talk a little bit about sort of the landscape of Absinthe these days. Got a lot more on the market, a lot of different flavor profiles, and we're going to explore that. And Laura is also going to bring us up to date on the current era of the ownership of the old Absinthe House and therefore Belle Epoque. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you as always. We are continuing our conversation with Dave Wondrich talking about the history of the old Absinthe House, and then we're going to chat a little bit further with Laura over there at Belle Epoque and get a little bit more about what's going on in their place and talk about the current era of the space. Dave, one thing I wanted to kind of clarify too for listeners, especially for local listeners who know what we're talking about. So we kind of had these two different places. We had the old Absinthe House, which is at 240 Bourbon Street at the corner of Bienville and Bourbon. Mm-hmm. And then when we kind of had the two operations, we had the Absinthe Room, right, or old Absinthe Room running. That's at 400 Bourbon, which is now Mango.
It was the old Absinthe House bar.
Excuse me. Right.
That's
okay.
What they called it.
Got it.
Because they had the actual bar.
And that was where all, right. So that's where all the stuff went for that period of time. And then now it's a Mango Daiquiri, which the current owner, that's also his chain. And that's actually where they do a lot of some of their office spaces and storage spaces, which is also a story for another time, Dave. I was telling you during the break some of that stuff.
Exactly. But I mean, you know, this is you could do like a year long podcast on this stuff.
Yeah, it's just absolutely.
So much. it's such a rich history. Yeah, the details there are many very crazy weird details.
Absolutely,
in the story and just spots there, they're like, what the hell is going on? Who are these people?
You know, Dave, you've given me a great idea. I'm just going to create an offshoot podcast. It'll probably be more popular than this one. I'm just going to call it Rummaging Through 400 Bourbon Street.
There you go. I love it.
Well, Dave, so some of the things, I want to let listeners know too, you're going to be down here in a few weeks to pay us another visit to the city, which you do fairly frequently.
Just for the hell of it.
This is just a for the hell of it kind of trip this time coming up?
Yeah. My wife and I are going down with some friends because we want to.
Awesome.
I mean, really. You don't need an excuse.
No.
I know you've got restaurants down there.
We have one or two.
Some nice bars. Yeah.
And one or two of those as well.
There are a couple bars I've heard of.
Yeah, some decent musicians.
I might come down for that.
Right. Yeah. That sounds great. Yeah, so this isn't one of these trips where you're compelled by events like Tales of the Cocktail to be here and show your face.
No, it's just, this is vacation.
Cool. Well, I'm going to make you work a little bit. We're concocting a plan here where we're going to do a show or two in here. Hopefully we'll do one. We sort of talk about the drinking culture of New Orleans, and we'll touch on some of these themes that we're hitting on a little bit here in this show about old Absinthe House. And then maybe we'll do another one where we pull our buddy Jeff Beach Bum Berry in, because the show that we did a few weeks, do you friends go check that out? It was in August when it aired. And that's priceless, because we started talking about dive bars in Milwaukee, as I recollect, Dave.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about things that are fun to talk about, and with Jeff is very good at that.
He is indeed.
You never know where the conversation
is. Exactly, and that fits in my production and pre-production planning, because I don't have to plan anything. We just go, so that'll be cool, yeah. Man. Awesome. Well, hey, Dave, let me ask you a couple things. There were some interesting themes, and again, why I was telling listeners what I was just saying is that we're going to kind of hit on the bigger picture New Orleans drinking culture stuff the next time we get together in a few weeks. But and so I didn't want to go too far down that road as we were sort of focused on the old Absinthe House today. But I think there were some interesting things that, a couple things you said towards the beginning when we were talking, the sort of idea of, we had the American sector, of course, which is now, today's CBD, or the American Quarter, excuse me, and then the French Quarter, of course, which is more the Creole part, and then as opposed to the sort of the Western European English part, American part, I should say. We had two very different drinking cultures. And I almost think it's kind of backwards in how you would think, because, I would kind of picture, you think French culture and all that, that we had these beautiful parlors and all this. But in a lot of ways, these drinking spaces, including the old Absinthe House in the 19th century, they were sort of, you dressed nicely and you behaved well, but they were a little more modest. Is that right?
Yeah, they were plain. They were small. They had much of the drinking happened in tables and basically at tables. You sat down at a table and you had a bottle of wine or a drink on the table. In the American places, the American style places went for the very flashy, heavily decorated, lots of brass and carved wood and. All that stuff now, that stuff seems quaint to us, but then that was very modern, that was the latest, and it was gaudy and flashy and wild. Like bars like the Sazerac House, definitely went more for that. And there you'd stand at the bar and you'd drink short drinks, not bottles of wine. You'd have cocktails iced. You'd have, Bimbo Punch was popular for a while, or Pig and Whistle. Those are old New Orleans drinks that are long gone. They were already gone by the end of the 1800s. Mm-hmm. But early on, they were popular for a little bit. And there were things like that. There were all these mixed drinks. The Julep was insanely popular, and there were a few others. Meanwhile, in the places like the old Absinthe House, the first I've seen it referred to as the Absinthe House is in 1864 in one of their ads. That's really early. That's, the place had only been open for like 20 years.
Right.
22 years, something like that, maybe a little more. But that's very early in its history, and it's already known for this. And they'd have they had the whole ritual of, you drip the water in and you slowly sip the absinthe. It's all very pleasant. It's very peaceful. It's not going to make you crazy like people, like the Americans thought absinthe was like this crazy poison that would drive them nuts, but that's because it was 120 proof. Right. If you were drinking it French Spanish style, you would have 1 ounce of that and 5 ounces of water. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't super strong at all. That was, it was like a nice mixed drink that was like an ounce and a half of regular booze, something like that.
And Dave, sorry to interrupt. So like a lot of these places, again, the culture there and drinking in these places. So yes, maybe you had absinthe, but you were talking about maybe it's a brandy, maybe it's a Spanish wine, and it's kind of this more restrained aspect, as opposed to say over in the American Quarter where you're drinking whiskey drinks and heavier cocktails like that. Yeah. You have like a couple drinks and it's just a nice thing to do on a daily basis or 5 days a week or whatever
it was. It was part of the day, it wasn't, In Anglo-Saxon culture, you go into a bar and you expect to be drinking,
Right.
And it's like, all right, especially in the evening, you go in and it's like, all right, now it's time to, pound down some drinks. In the French culture, the Spanish culture, it's more like, you might pop in the morning and have one and pop in another time in the afternoon and have another, but it wasn't like it was just part of your day. It wasn't just this kind of cut off. So you weren't in this special I'm drinking space where, well, whatever, everything I'm doing from now on will be drinking. It was a little more woven into the day to day.
Right. Okay. And there was like music going on like to a degree in some of these places at that time, or did that kind of come later?
The music, the place, the bars that had music, as far as I could tell, were the dives over across Rampart Street.
In the Storyville stuff.
Yeah, at those places, that's where we had music. At places like Pig Ankle Hall, and there are a couple other places like that. But if you had music, that was for dancing, you know. And dancing meant that there were other attractions to the place.
Right, exactly. Okay. So one of the things also that I wanted to say, I find that sort of juxtaposition very interesting, just because we talk about modest spaces, but we are talking about sort of, you know, you dress nicely and you're on good behavior and yeah. You have a couple drinks and you socialize and then you move on. It's not this sort of a binge drinking kind of situation or party central like we see on Bourbon Street today. It was very refined, and it does sit in a stark contrast to the American Quarter, where like a lot of whiskey, right, Dave? Is that correct to assume in a lot of the cocktails?
There's a lot of whiskey. Whiskey was king. Gin cocktails also. I mean, there were American drinking even was a little more spread out during the day than it is now. Also, so it's not quite so black and white. Mm-hmm. People would pop into the bar for a cocktail and then they'd leave and then come back, you know, an hour and a half later for another one. Then they'd leave and go back to work. I mean, you know, you weren't operating heavy machinery. You didn't have to talk on the phone. Life was a little different. If you were making deals, it was face to face with people. You know? Right, so you might go and have a drink with them. Life was a little more forgiving to the drinking man.
Right. Gotcha. There you go. So let me ask you this too, because I think it was really interesting. I know a couple things here. We sort of ran quickly through the prohibition part of the story, and you know, we know New Orleans in general. This is something we'll talk about when you're here in a few weeks. But you know, it didn't shut the city down. Some people were, I'll use the word, dissuaded from continuing to sell liquor, and we'll do that, you know, again in the future. But you know, the old Absinthe House kind of maintained that, but in a lot of ways, you know, it was like some of the places that continued to maintain it with a sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of thing going on. And I found it interesting though, you point out that. I'm forgetting which owner, I apologize, that he was kind of using figureheads to run. So he's putting different people out front to take
Casaubon,
the heat. Was that Casaubon? Okay, right. So he had like people that he was sort of putting out there. So he got busted a couple times, as you said. And then he says, well, hey, I'm going to put the bartender out front, or I'm going to put a relative out front there and kind of be the face man for the business and see if they take some of the heat.
Yeah.
Although that didn't really seem to work out, right, because the check registers and ledgers still led to him.
Yeah, he paid all their legal bills. So you know
right.
Who was really in charge.
Okay.
But whoever's paying the lawyers, that's the guy who's in charge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, but, you know, he tried everything. I mean, he was resourceful, and he really wanted to just run his business. And he wanted to, you know, run the Absinthe House. For him, it was inconceivable that the place should be closed and not selling drinks. It's the old Absinthe House, goddammit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been there. It was the oldest bar in New Orleans then already, or pretty close to, if not. And it was, you know, one of the most famous bars in the world. It should have been open. He just couldn't, it just didn't compute. It's like, you know, some people upstate and in other states basically made me close my bar. Why?
Right. You know, and again, Dave, as I said earlier, funny how things in Louisiana don't change. People upstate versus people in New Orleans or nationally. Yeah.
You know, we're seeing some of the same stuff going on nationally that led to prohibition. You know?
Exactly.
There's a whole, you people down there are corrupt and immoral and screw you. You know, we're going to, we don't want you to enjoy what you're doing. And so we're going to revoke your privileges.
Exactly.
There's a lot of that, and the people. Meanwhile, the people in the city were just like, you know, I'm not doing anything. I'm just doing my job, and now it's been taken away. So that's my part. That's maybe a little more my perspective on it.
I think that's true. New Orleans has kind of always been that way. It's sort of like, you know, why get in the way of a good thing consideration? And I think that a lot of these places like Old Absinthe House was indicative of that. And you know, and why I wanted to bring this up too, again, we'll talk more detail about this the next time you're on, but prohibition obviously still changed the drinking culture of New Orleans quite a bit. And we saw that, you know, that transition through the old Absinthe House. And then we talked about, you know, some of the different ownership through then. And then we talked about when Owen Brennan took it over, and obviously Ella had a big consideration on how that the place was run, you know, as far as hospitality mm-hmm. goes and things. But there was something, and I'm forgetting exactly how you phrased it in the piece. I think it's the fourth part of the series. That was a kind of a watershed transformation of going from what it had been for the better part of a century, really a century plus, to being a Brennan space. So the notion of hospitality changed, a lot of the decor changed, a lot of the entertainment changed. So this kind of transformed to a more modern New Orleans consideration, which is now kind of traditional, I guess, but you know what I'm saying?
I mean, the Brennans were up to date, you know, they had a good hand on PR. They knew celebrities. There was an apartment upstairs that they let celebrities stay in, some of their friends, including black celebrities who couldn't get a hotel in New Orleans. You know, Owen said, yeah, stay upstairs. Not a problem. We got you covered. So, they kind of ran the thing. There was a little bit of Hollywood in it, you know,
okay.
in how they did it. Ella, they bought the restaurant across the street, and she worked more with that. And at first, you know, the Absinthe House was just a bar. But then they had this restaurant across the street, and that started to get really good and started to get famous. They changed the name to Brennan's, and they moved it down to Royal Street. Yeah. But it took more and more of their energies, you know, because they realized that, you know, there's more to the world than just running a saloon. Even if it's this wildly successful kind of theme park of a saloon, which is how they ran it as basically an ode to old New Orleans, you know. And but at the same time, they had the best bartenders in town, or some of them, and their hospitality was unmatched. Everybody, you know, Owen was a great character and a great figurehead for the bar. He would be seen eating a hot dog from the hot dog cart outside the bar with a glass of champagne in his hand. That's Owen.
There you go. That's New Orleans, man. Right, right.
That's the Brennan's today. You know, I mean, they're kind of local royalty, but they're not personally fancy people. You know?
Exactly.
The ones I know a lot of the family. I've never found any of them to be stuck up.
No, not at all. They're very approachable, and you know, you see them. Yeah, absolutely.
And you know. And they're local, you know, mm-hmm. and proud of it. Mm-hmm. And so that was Owen. But that image is great, great for me. That was the beginning of their dynasty, and okay. it did well for them. But they did well for it for a while there.
And that was kind of a bit of a transformation, as we're talking about here, that it kind of borrowing some of the stuff, the success that was going on with Pat O'Brien's, right? Had a little bit of an influence.
Exactly.
There on. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Pat O'Brien's was a huge influence. Pat O'Brien's had music. Pat O'Brien's had hoo-ha and ballyhoo, et cetera. And it was just unbelievably popular. But it was also kind of a little bit of a rougher, more vulgar place. And the Brennan's, Owen thought they would take the energy of Pat O'Brien's and make it a little bit nicer, you know, make it a little less rowdy, a little older crowd, less, you know, underage drinking and stuff like that. Just make it a cool, fun place to be, but at the same time, with a little limit there.
And the kind of thing too, where you would still, you would get dressed up because you're going out. It's a place that you would go out to, not as opposed to just yes. go party on Bourbon Street kind of place.
Exactly. It was a destination.
Got it.
You know, and on Bourbon Street was already moving down more towards the Bourbon Street of today by the 1950s. There's a lot of talk about the vulgarization of Bourbon Street. And then by the 1960s, after the Brennan sold it, there are lots of arrests for prostitution in the bar. There's an arrest for watering their booze. There's all kinds of just real dysfunction going on. And, I mean, just as was urban America at the time,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I'm from New York, and New York in the 1970s was quite an eye-opener, as was Bourbon Street.
I remember being in Times Square in 1980s, Dave, and it was an eye-opener.
Yeah, I mean, no, when New York gets seedy, nobody does seedy like New York.
That's where I got my first fake ID, man.
Yeah, of course you did. I mean, there was, you know, there were Marcello's running the bar for a while. You know, there were heroin deals. There was all kinds of stuff. It was pretty bad. But then it wobbled out of that phase and just, you know, kind of got into now where it's basically throwing a net out for the tourists. I mean, the main bar room and, you know, hauling people in and they're drinking whatever they drink and but it's not a place for fine drinking like it was, under the Brennans.
Who,
you know, kept that line.
Now, it will. We're excited about this, Dave, to change, though, with Bella Pock opening in the back and being a kind of and changing that vibe in the backspace. What was the, you know, the main dining room of Moran's? And we're going to talk about
that shortly. I've got high
hopes. I do, too.
Because it would be nice to see.
Absolutely. And that's who we were talking with before you came on, who we're going to talk with after about their program there. And it's a beautiful space and all that good stuff. Let me ask you one last question, Dave, before I know you got to scoot.
Sure.
This was something that I had not heard of when I was reading your pieces. So we were talking about the influence that Pat O'Brien's had on, you know, some stuff that Owen Brennan and the Brennan family borrowed in running the spot, Old Absinthe House then. And, you know, kind of taking that signature cocktail idea thing. And they had one which I had never heard of until reading your piece called The Pirate's Dream. And I became very intrigued about that. Yeah. So,
there was a lot of booze in it.
Okay. Right. So what do you have? Did you find a recipe for it, or are we kind of aware?
I've got one somewhere. Let me see if I can dig it up. It was nothing too distinguished. It wasn't particularly original, but, it was effective, I think. And, that was the whole point.
Kind of like a hurricane knockoff, lot of rum, lot of fruit juice kind of thing.
Yeah, basically. Yep. Big tall drink with lots of rum in it.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Hold on. I've got juice of an orange, 1/2 ounce of grenadine, 1 ounce of Bacardi, 1 ounce of Myers, rum, juice of 1 lemon. So a whole lot of juice, only 2 ounces of rum so far. 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, 1 ounce of Christopher Columbus rum, whatever the hell that is, and then 1 ounce of 151 proof rum. So now we're up to 4 ounces of rum, some of it very strong. Then you add mint and those ingredients, and you fill up a huge tall glass with it, and good night, sweet prince.
There you go, a hurricane by another name. I like it.
yeah, exactly. Except without the expensive passion fruit.
Right, there you go. A working man's hurricane. I'll rephrase that little bit.
Yeah.
Well, great, Dave. I really appreciate you making time today, man. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And once again, tell people, I really want to encourage people. We obviously gave it somewhat short shrift. We went really quickly through the history. All four pieces are great reads. It tells you a lot about New Orleans. It tells you a lot about the drinking culture of New Orleans, the history of the city, all kind of woven in through the story of the Old Absinthe House. I want to encourage people to go read that. They can find that and all the rest of your writings at dailybeast.com, right?
The Daily Beast. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk, and I look forward to next time.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks, Dave. Take care, man. Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, everybody, we're going to take a little break. We'll be back with Laura at Bella Pock. Yep, another shot with NOLA Drinks rolls on, friends. I hope you enjoyed the conversation we had there with the one and only Dave Wondrich. He's a super knowledgeable guy, great guy. And as we were talking about in the interview, Dave is going to be here in a few weeks, and we're going to do another show with him, talking about sort of the history of the drinking culture in New Orleans, which is going to be really cool. We kind of, Laura, you hadn't heard it yet, but we're going to, you know, we talked about, we kind of used the Old Absinthe House to tell the story pretty quickly of the history of the building. But as you know, in the pieces that he wrote, it's in a lot of ways, it tells a lot of the story of New Orleans and also the drinking culture in New Orleans, of the effects of Civil War and Prohibition and all that stuff. And so when it became a tourist town in the late 19th century, and so Dave's going to come back and we're going to do a show. I think we might tape it in this space, actually, if you all have us again. And sort of just, talk about the broader history of drinking culture in New Orleans. So I'm looking forward to that, because Dave is always a pleasure to have on. And as we discussed with Dave Friends, as you heard, it's a lot more fun. We did, you know, Dave was by phone, as you all know. It's a lot more fun to have Dave in person, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. He's a blast.
he you know, it was funny, Laura, because we did a show with he and Jeff Barry when he was here during Tales. And
yeah.
And then we brought Dave over here. And we actually taped that one at Two Jags, and they were ordering something, whiskey, something, something. And then I said, I want a Sazerac with cognac. And they both went, ooh, I want one of those too, and changed their order. I'm like, okay. You know, I mean, I got the world famous Jeff Barry and the world famous Dave Wondrich to order what I ordered in a bar.
That's pretty amazing.
I felt pretty cool about
oh
myself
my gosh,
there.
I know.
Yeah.
I feel cool when you brought them here. I was like, nerding out hardcore.
Well, right on. So really quickly, because I promised this to listeners in the previous segment, we got to the part where it was the property Old Absinthe House was owned by Bricado and Moran, Tony Moran, as we were discussing. So who has it now? Let's kind of close the final chapter there.
Yeah. So our owner is Jobert Salim, and he basically got to know them through one working in Italian restaurants all over the quarter. And also he owned the property across the street from them. So they were like business owner friends.
Okay.
And neighbors. So when they were ready to kind of, so then he bought 400 Bourbon before he bought this building. And that mm-hmm. was really important because 400 was housing the Old Absinthe
right,
House
we
bar
talked about that
and all
with
the
Dave. Yeah, right.
All the accessories and accoutrement, all of the stuff that you see around this bar now was in that building.
Right.
And that was owned by Joe Sinatra. And Joe Sinatra sold that to our owner, Jobert. So then he had all the stuff that went inside the bar. And then a couple years later, he acquired the actual bar and got to make the historic move of moving the original bar, those original fountains, and all of the art back into
right,
this building.
Right.
And could only do that once he owned both.
Right, got it.
So that was kind of the last chapter of the homecoming of all of our stuff
mm-hmm.
and all of our historic treasures coming to one building.
Cool, thank you. Because we ran out of time with Dave, so we need to kind of close the chapter there and let you guys know where we stand today with the history of the Old Absinthe House, and now we've done that. So Laura, let's talk about this, because one of the things that I was really excited to talk to you about, and we kind of touched on this a little bit in the first segment you were on, it's still a pretty small category, absinthe. We mentioned how people are very passionate that are involved in making it and those that are big fans of consuming it. But we are seeing a lot of new ones, right? I mean, both old world, new, and now
yeah.
that it, and then we see a lot of American
I
distillers
think it's
really
doing
it.
Fun.
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, you obviously are looking to France for those classic kind of soft, light, but highly botanical absinthe. I think the American category of absinthe is exploding right now, and they're making the sort of wild, quirky ones that we all would wonder kind of what it would be like if that absinthe distiller did that. So you have Emerald from Bastrop, Texas, which is just loading their absinthe with herbs. They use double the herbs of all the original recipes.
Oh, wow.
So it's
okay.
just this insane flavor bomb, and it's beautiful, and it's super intense, and you don't really see absinthe coming out of France that tastes like that. And then you see, like, St. George is a really good example from California
yeah.
where they have this sort of pininess and this sort of almost alpine absinthe flavor profile going on, which is really beautiful. And then you have people getting even crazier, the even newer ones like Leatherby, where they're barrel aging their absinthe to soften out the edges, and it's got this sort of brown color, and it's almost bourbony absinthe, and it's got this oakiness, and it's got okay. this like beautiful flavor. So there's so much going on right now with absinthe. I think it's really cool.
That's really cool. And you, the three folks that you mentioned there, I think that's pretty neat, because we're talking about some really fine craft distillers that you know, their whole line is really good.
Oh yeah.
So it's cool to see them take on absinthe as another product that they're doing.
Yeah, and I know that like St. George had been working on it for so long before it got legalized mm-hmm. that they were just so excited to kind of give this to the world. And then we have Absinthia, who's a brand new distiller, who's like a Burning Man absinthe maker.
That's California, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she would bring it to Burning Man all the time with her. And
it's oh, really?
Beautiful, organic, super light, super delicate absinthe, like almost a whisper of like this clean wormwood flavor. It's beautiful. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm fascinated by all the absinthes that are coming out right now.
Yeah, that's cool. So, I mean, that kind of leads up to my next question, is that then that gives you a bigger palette with which to play with cocktails, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm lucky to be... This is a good time to open an absinthe farm. That's what I'm
right,
saying.
Right.
I'm lucky to have so many things to play with, and it's nice, too, to have local absinthe. Like, Toulouse is made in New Orleans, so you can have that local option like you always want to have for every other spirit category.
Right.
We have that in absinthe.
Yeah, you know, and the Toulouse, he does a red, which is that's kind of, and that's that started, I think, right in Switzerland. Is that where the first red absinthe came from? Do we know?
I don't know where the first. That's a really
okay.
good question.
Yeah,
I will look that up.
I thought maybe that was the
Swiss
case. I could
is
have
blanche,
that wrong.
France is more vert, but like yeah. the red is kind of not something I've seen a lot of classic reds because mm-hmm. It's a hibiscus flower dye, and it's sort of like this new, fun, exciting like floral absinthe.
Okay, yeah, you know, I've always been a fan of the Toulouse red, and to give Jed there who makes it his props at the distillery, I hadn't tasted the green in a while, and the green has gotten a lot better since the last time I tasted it.
Yeah, I think too, when you changed the bottle, that really made a difference. It kind of made it all sort of cool. I know he designed this himself, so I think like, that was one thing where he got to put a little bit more of himself in it and make it a little bit more kind of trippy in his vibe. Mm-hmm. And I think that really makes it stand out on a shelf and is just fun to sell.
Do you think the category, because we've kind of made it clear that there are more people making it,
yes.
both here and in Europe. And there was, we've done shows, Friends in the past, go check it out on our website about like sort of the history of absinthe. So we don't need to get too far into like the legalization of it and so on. That's been covered pretty well. We'll do that again in the future. But do you think that the category is growing among consumers as well? And now that people are easier, they can find it easier. It's not scary anymore.
Exactly. I think a lot of, like what we've had in terms of people contacting us has been people being like, I'm from this state and I like this absinthe. Do you have something like it?
So oh,
I
wow. think okay. Interesting.
That there's like a lot of people kind of going and finding their own stuff and experimenting with it and learning what they like and don't like. That's carrying over to us. And we're like, hey, maybe we can get that. Maybe we can like get that in Louisiana someday and stuff like that. So it's kind of just everyone's developing their palate. And you do, I mean, it's got a lot of similar botanicals, so you do kind of have to have a picky palate to tell the differences between all of them. But once you taste a lot of it, you kind of find the differences, which is what we're hoping for Belle.
Yeah, and that's pretty cool. So with the ones that we're seeing pop out there, because there's not really any sort of regulatory consideration as far as what, I mean, so is there kind of a same base set of herbs that pretty much everybody's using, and then there's the spin from there?
Yeah. So there's a couple rules, and there's
like there are
the main herbs. So you always have wormwood, anise, and fennel.
Okay.
Always.
Right.
And then
okay.
there's about 14 supporting herbs that people use, and a lot of absinthe, like Lefay is a really good example, mm-hmm. has like one herb that's very specific to them that makes their absinthe taste that way. And I think they use gentian, which is that sort of.
That would make sense.
Yeah. Yep. So they're each, and there's no rules about the herb. So I think people are getting more into, well, this is the specific herb that defines our absinthe. But there are rules. You can't have any added sugar or it's not absinthe. It's absinthe liqueur. You can't have any chemicals, like added artificial chemicals or artificial color. It has to be dyed with the plants that you're using, and it has to be no sugar added, which is why it doesn't give you much of a hangover, which is amazing.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay, so now is that something that's sort of recognized by, say, like the EU and here in the States, so that it's not just like a handshake deal with everybody?
No, it's super strict. Like you cannot call it an absinthe if you're putting a bunch of sugar, and if you are, the absinthe community like has a lot of bad feelings about you.
And they revolt on Facebook groups?
It's the worst,
okay, got it.
The worst thing that can happen. It's terrible. I've seen it happen.
Interesting. So now, to be clear too, kind of what does make absinthe absinthe? I mean, wormwood is that key ingredient, because then we have things that are like anisettes, right? Like herbsaint.
Yeah.
It doesn't have wormwood, but it does have a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, the broad category is anisettes. And I think culturally speaking, there aren't very many cultures that don't have like a distillate anisette that represents them. There's ouzo, there's sambuco, there's always people looking for this. And the reason is because, I mean, I'm sure you've talked about this already, but absinthe is originally sort of a curative medicine,
right.
and the herbs in it are digestives, and they help, the bitterness helps you digest quickly, and the anise helps you digest. So any culture that kind of was using an alcohol as a medicine was using bitterness in alcohol to help you digest for a very long time. So that's kind of where it all comes from, I think.
Right. Look, and I've never asked this question before, but just for listeners, because I think, how would you characterize the difference between Amaro and absinthe? Because they're kind of sort of related, right?
I mean, that's really cool. I would say that Amaro is usually like much darker in color and has sort of those chocolatey woody notes, whereas absinthe tends to be more like fresh, herbaceous, and clean.
Okay.
I would say that's the main difference. A really good example of someone who stands like right on that line would be like a chartreuse.
Right, exactly.
Where it's like a liqueur, yeah, but it has kind of this heavy depth and this like bigness to it and this roundness, but it also has all this botanical stuff going on. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's also a digestif.
That's a really, I appreciate that explanation, because I think lots of times too, people, this happens with clear distillates too, Laura. I think, you know, we're especially here in the United States, we're pretty bad at categorizing clear distillates. You know, everybody yeah, wants to boil it down to like vodka and gin,
yeah,
and then maybe like Blanco tequila and, yeah, and so mezcal, really what we're talking about. But then when we go look at like the old world, like in Europe and stuff, there's all these caraway driven, you know, there's Geneva, yes, and Palugar and all these different ones out there, that there's all, it's a huge world out there. And so the reason why I even just asked that question and bring it up is that these things, they're not these hard lines.
Oh,
I mean,
not at
there's
all,
kind of blurring of lines. And
yeah, and I think what it says about each culture and the time frame that it was invented in is so fascinating. And drinking it, I mean, that's kind of how I got into chartreuse, as like drinking it as a piece of history as much as drinking it because it tastes awesome.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I like that. Well, so you're still working up new cocktails kind of and always workshopping here?
Oh, yeah, we are. I mean, with all the people and the new people too, they're getting creative and they're getting to get their hands dirty finally. So we are just playing around as much as we can. We did an Herb Saint mold wine last night for Halloween that went over very well.
Interesting.
But we're kind of, yeah, when we can do a daily special, we're doing it. We're just kind of playing around and having a ball.
Awesome. So one more time, Laura, tell people where they can find y'all on the street and find y'all online, as I like to say.
We are at 240 Bourbon Street, and you can find us at rubourbon.com. And if you want to check out our Instagram, it's bellapocnola.
Awesome. Laura, thanks so much for having us here today.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for coming here.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. And friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I will be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show this week, friends. I do appreciate it as always. Quick programming note for you. Next week, got a great show coming up for you. We are going to be chatting with the noted historian, culinary historian, Dr. Jessica Harris, who was in town recently to participate in a symposium at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And we got a chance to sit down with her just this week and talk with her about foodways, the influences and contributions of food and of culinary history by the African diaspora, and many other interesting topics. A very fascinating woman, and it was a great conversation. We just actually taped it, as I said. That's our show next week, so stay tuned for that one. Friends, this is our parting shot. We're going to keep it fairly short here. You know, I mentioned this in the interview with Laura when we were talking about absinthe. I have been a fan of the spirit for quite some time, and I'm fairly close to it in certain ways. And I kind of, you know, when that happens, you kind of forget the perception of the rest of the world. And I asked her that question, are people still kind of freaked out about it? And I kind of forgot, because, you know, to me, it's just a non-starter. It's a non-issue. It doesn't make you crazy. It's not toxic. It's not a hallucinogen. That was really never the case. You know, so again, I just kind of forgot about all that stuff, and I don't even really consider it. But apparently a lot of people out there are still kind of freaked out about it, and there's a mystery to it. And it's really unnecessary. Basically, as it goes, wormwood, as we talked about, is one of the main ingredients in absinthe. As a matter of fact, and people kind of freak out about wormwood because they think, again, that it was a hallucinogen. It is not, and it never was, and it never will be. And as a matter of fact, most absinthes that were produced before the ban in the early part of the 20th century, almost all of those would be legal today with their level of wormwood. And there's an active ingredient in it called thujone, and that's really what everybody focuses on, or that's where the issue comes from. Now, most of those absinthes did not even come close to having the level of wormwood, therefore thujone, that would even make it illegal today. That is also absolutely positively untrue. Now, if you take a super high level of thujone and give it to somebody, it is potentially a dangerous neurotoxin, but we are talking levels, parts per million, that are so much higher than even you come remotely close to in absence of old or absence of today, that it's a non-issue. It reminds me of some of the food experiments that were done decades ago, I want to say in the 1950s, if I'm not mistaken, could be wrong about that, where people would push the amount of vitamin A or vitamin C or vitamin D to extreme levels, and also strip people from being able to have other vitamins, so isolating the effects of extreme concentrations of a single vitamin. And yes, and those will be toxic too when you go about doing it that way. The same thing applies here to wormwood, and as I said, thujone, the ingredient there. Now, there is also a little bit of a mystery or myth that, you know, it was made illegal in the early part of the 20th century, both in Europe and in the United States. But then people think that going back to, I think it was about 2007 or about 12 years in or so, that quote unquote, it was made legal again because we drinkers, people that were in absinthe, pressured the U.S. government and the EU to make it legal. That is actually not really true either. Now, we've talked about this on the show before with George from Lafay Absinthe, George Rowley from Lafay Absinthe. You can go back to our website, noladrinks.com, and check that out. And I'm sure that we will talk about it again. There is a little bit of, how shall I say, conflict in the story that you'll get from George, and then maybe you get from somebody like Ted Bro, who makes an absinthe made in France, but a brand based here called Lucid. We'll probably have Ted on the show sometime in the future and get that side of the story. But regardless, the idea here was that it was really never illegal, at least going back to perhaps the 30s. There's some argument for that, or even the 60s, because it had to do with the parts per million of the level of Thujon. And as I mentioned, absinthe, even old ones, almost virtually none of the ones today, have anywhere near that limit. So really what it was pointing out to the authorities in the EU and pointing out to the authorities in the United States that absinthe in the way that it would be made now would not violate any laws already on the book. So there really was no ban, and no laws have ever been changed if you look at it from that perspective. It was sort of a discovery of information that is key here in how absinthe is made, what the level of Thujon is, and how wormwood is used in its production. And as a matter of fact, vermouth is really the French adaptation of the word vermut, which I believe I'm probably pronouncing wrong, which is the German word for wormwood. And a lot of vermouth actually, I think today probably still uses wormwood, some of them anyway. And way back when, wormwood was very commonly used in vermouth, hence the name. So I'm telling you all this kind of stuff, friends, because really not a whole lot's changed other than the fact that a lot more people are making absinthe these days, both in the United States or brand, a lot of them are made there, but are US-based brands or, you know, made in Europe. And it's not something to be afraid of. It's a very tasty spirit, a very interesting spirit. And now that we see, as I said, the only thing that's really changed is the proliferation of brands and flavor profiles out there. So it's a great world. It's a great spirit to go out and explore. And I promise it won't make you hallucinate and it won't make you crazy. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you. All these sayings and all these sinners we'll try.